Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host. All things Earth Ancients. Hey, I hope most of you are checking out the Facebook page. As you know, we've had a number of guests talking about Mars and the relation to ancient Earth civilizations and the Cydonia region. And I've tried to keep that Facebook page, Earth Ancients, Facebook Startling New Discoveries from our planet's distant past, pretty clear of Mars material, except for the occasional photo. But after the interview that I had with Dr. Brandenburg, I decided to feature a select handful of images from some of the top image specialists. Mollilari was on there a few times, but I want to basically announce that I'm putting on about one or two photos per week of some of the real amazing areas that are just outside of Cydonia as well as Cydonia. And a couple of days ago, a processing specialist who used to actually work with NASA, he will not give out his name for various reasons. He's still actually working within the special agency, sent me a photograph of one of the most amazing, what looks like a machine. And I posted it a couple of days ago, and it is a cone-shaped object with a foundation that looks like it's metal. And what he did is he does very light enhancements, which basically means he takes the rover's image and processes it in such a way that he lights it just a little bit. So he's not recoloring the image, which is what a lot of people do. But he just highlighted and kicked the light up a little bit. And what we see is a structure that must have been part of a large machine. It has a foundation. It has it's a solid metal piece, and he actually reconstructed it because it's so clear. And when I see objects like this just spread all over the surface of the planet, Dr. Brandenburg's theory becomes very plausible that there was a tremendous event. In his belief, it was a nuclear event on the surface that just destroyed buildings, structures, you know, devastated whatever human or plant or animal life was on the surface, and really shows that there was a sophisticated society there. Now, when the government begins to fess up and say, hey, you know, this is what the rover is taking pictures of, and we must now claim, which a lot of scientists that are working on Mars have claimed a long time ago, that there is archaeology on the surface of the planet. So And I don't say that lightly. I don't just say it because, oh, it's a theory. It's a great theory. And, the face is a real deal. And I mean, this is, you know, been validated by numerous scientists. And as if you remember, if you heard that conversation I had with Dr. Brandenburg, the government isn't hiding it anymore. Now, JPL may be hiding it. Mike Malin and his group in Pasadena may be hiding it because they don't want to have that information revealed. They want to keep a lid on it. But when I see photographs like this image, and by the way, you can go to Facebook. It's in the blog section. It's in the group. So go to Facebook, go to groups, and you'll see it there. It's a cone-shaped object. It's very metallic looking. Looks like it's about 5 feet high by about 4.5 feet wide. It's very angular. Doesn't look natural at all. It looks like a machine. But when you see things like that, it's like, come on. I mean, what are you guys? You gotta get off of this. There's nothing on Mars, and we're just still doing soil samples. You know, it's just crazy. So anyhow, take a look at that. It's kind of cool. I have the pleasure of announcing a new book by Zachariah Sitchin. This book is going to be coming out late summer. It's called The Anunnaki Chronicles. And I just spoke with the publisher, Inner Traditions, and I happen to be one of the administrators to Zach's Facebook page, and I keep an eye on it and continually move on with it. But the other administrator, the main administrator, is Janet Sitchin, who is Zachariah Sitchin's niece. And she is going to be my guest on in late July to discuss the Anunnaki Chronicles. Now, the unique part of this book is this is a book that Sitchin was writing when he passed away. He passed away in 2010, and he was like 92. So, you know. But anyhow, when he passed, he left a number of articles that hadn't been published, as well as he was transcribing lectures that he had given that had not been released to the public. So this book, The Anunnaki Chronicles, is filled with his ideas about the 12th planet, the Anunnaki, obviously, and a number of other research items that he found were quite critical to his work. So I'm really happy to hear that. Janet is very dedicated to her uncle's memory and is the actual editor of this book, along with the editors at Inner Traditions in Vermont. So look for that. I'm really excited to have her on the program because she literally compiled this, and she has some really kind of interesting things to say about his perspective and a lot of the notes that she found after he passed away. He was a friend of mine. I had Zachary at a number of conferences, and so this is kind of exciting for me. And of course, if you're a fan of the Earth Chronicle series or any of Zachariah Sitchin's books, you should definitely tune in for that program. So we're talking about viral mythology today, and the book Viral Mythology is written by Marie Jones, and is a fascinating book on how information gets passed. Now, viral, if you're on the internet as much as I am, when something goes viral, what happens? Virility in subject matter and communication means that it's so popular that everyone has to see it. As an example, I'll give you a really easy example. I'm a fan of Taylor Swift. I love her music. I just think she's kind of cool. And whenever she posts a article on Facebook, a photo of herself and friends, or an introduction to some music, it goes viral. What does that mean? Well, literally, it's, I got to know what's going on with Taylor Swift. I think it's to the point now where it doesn't really matter what she posts. But as an example, she posted a introduction to a song that she wrote with the Civil Wars, which is a group that actually co-wrote it with her. This thing went viral to the point where within 1 week, 20 million, that's million people, had downloaded or had opened up YouTube to listen to this song. And it's just mind-blowing, the virility of those kinds of things and how it spread so quickly. But the question we have today is how information was passed among the ancients. And this book, Viral Mythology, is actually forwarded by a friend of ours, Dr. Heather Lynn. And we have Heather on the program right now. And Heather's forward is unique because she rightly so, you know, shows us that the history that we understand today is only a couple of hundred years old. And so how was information passed? And she actually came up with a really cool kind of a thought, theory. She called it the cosmic cloud computing theory. And how are you, Heather? How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you, Cliff?
I'm great. I'm great. Hey, tell us about this introduction and what your thinking is around fields. Now, you mentioned Rupert Sheldrake in your program, in your intro. And now he's the his thought is the morphogenic field, right?
Right. He has a morphic resonance.
It's a morphic resonance.
Where self-organizing systems inherit a memory from previous similar systems. So it's sort of like symbolism, archetypes, and stuff. I liken it to that. He's speaking more of I don't want to say legitimate scientific field, because a lot of people, you know, are put off by him and call him pseudoscience, et cetera, et cetera. But I would say his morphic resonance and morphic field theory is based in more hard science, whereas with archaeology, as you know, it's more of a soft science. So I sort of look at that and say, well, still, if you consider people like Jung and some of the more either soft science or humanitarian, you know, liberal artists, if you sort of use an interdisciplinary approach and see how both of those could explain these weird kind of, you know, viral mythologies of the past, it sort of relates. It kind of, it broadens the, you know, the idea of it, I think, a little bit more for people, rather than just sticking with it. Like, is this a mystery? Is this science? What can we know? And through archaeology, archaeology can only explain so much. And a lot of it is more based in the physical realm. And as you said earlier, archaeology is really only a few hundred years old in terms of an organized science. So there's really a lot more to it. So I think by looking through other fields, other scholars, and sort of taking all that information and applying that to the archaeological record, we can get a little bit of a better idea as to maybe what caused these ancient ideas and truths to become so-called viral throughout history and even today.
Yeah. Now, as an archaeologist and a doctor in comparative religion, would you, in your studies of ancient history, have you felt that there is kind of a level of unknown fields, as Marie and Larry discuss in the book, where they're, because you give an example of a known language being passed among different civilizations, And this is something that I was questioning Marie about, which is that there's gods, and every ancient civilization has their gods, the Greek gods, the Roman gods, and they all kind of have, and the Mayan gods, and they all have similar traits and attributes, and it's like they all kind of connected in one cloud of computing information, and it all kind of was dispersed, and it's like they all kind of went, oh yeah, it's Zeus, and it, yeah. And Zeus has this, and it's the serpent god of the Maya, and he has these attributes, but they're the same as the Greek attributes. So it's all kind of strange. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think when you consider the symbols, the iconography of it, those relate to cultural identity. So you have things like Zeus, and he may look a certain way. He looks a little more Mediterranean or even European, of course. But then you can, you know, look at other symbols, and they in, you know, Africa, and they take on the colors, the symbols, the skin tones, the features of the people there. But as you said, those underlying values and attributes are still there. And so, you know, as I say in the foreword, you know, when stripped of the cultural identity of these messages and symbols, it's the core message stays the same. It's like, you know, I look at it like taking Occam's razor and just, you know, it's cutting that all down and saying, okay, yes, Zeus looked like this, or this was a snake-headed this, or whatever, but let's get all those cultural, you know, artifacts, because those, you know, are still artifacts. They were created by man. So those images were created by man. What are the underlying truths of that? And what you find is that they're all almost virtually identical. And I use the example in the foreword of Viral Mythology of the universality of the golden rule, which is, I think, very interesting. It's a very basic premise. But in Buddhism, they say, hurt not others with that pains thyself. And even in the Tale of the Eloquent Peasant from ancient Egyptian, you know, late period, it says that which you hate to be done to you, do not do to another. You can look at classical paganism where Plato says, may I do to other as I would do that they do unto me. So you hear the syntax, the linguistic syntax is different. The style is different. The time period is different. And even, you know, you could say, well, one influenced the other and so on and so on. But then the Pima proverb of Native American spirituality says, do not wrong or hate your neighbor, for it is not he who you wrong, but yourself. So there's all these, as I said, eloquent ways. And we have the golden rule. Islam says something very similar. So does Christianity, of course, and Judaism. Everywhere, through all religions and cultures, you will find the golden rule. And that is a given, and that's a fact. How they display that golden rule, whether it be through a particular proverb in their language or some kind of art, that's different. But those differences, those are artifacts. Those are man-made representations of cultural identity. So with that being said, you have to wonder, where is this underneath principle coming from? What is driving this? What could be called the universal truth behind it, which is, as we call it in now our culture, the golden rule. But still, there's something there that everybody, and from all geographic areas, from all time periods, they still recognize this basic principle. And so it really, that I think is something that really can leave you wondering. But it's, so, you know, the unified message of empathic reciprocity is there, but it's just dressed up as something else that is unique to that inherent culture and time. So those are the things that it makes me wonder. So archaeology can only answer so much. It can only say, well, you know, let's identify the region and basically the artifacts, the package, if you will, that it came in. But right. You have to look a little deeper and say, yeah, but what's driving this ultimate message? How is this transmitted? And how did it seemingly go viral in ancient times and still resonates today? And so that's why I referenced the morphic resonance theory of Rupert Sheldrake and Jung. And it's admittedly not a hard scientific theory, the cosmic cloud computing, but it's one that I kind of subscribe to in the back of my mind when looking at these data.
Well, listen, Heather, you are the rogue archaeologist, so here we go. I mean, let's you actually
I'm
even
not
say
traditional.
That.
Renegade.
Well, that's what I love about you is that you're classically trained and you're an archaeologist, but you look a little bit outside the box, and that's why I think you're so popular. But I have to ask you this. Do you think there's something missing? Do you think there's an evolutionary part of humanity that has been overlooked simply because we don't have the technology or a way to measure consciousness, and consciousness being possibly what you could say are within the Akashic records, which is a very metaphysical term, which is kind of like a cloud in some dimension that has everything that's happened in the past and the present and the future, and that these ancient societies were actually able to tap into that, and that's why you have similarities in different cultures. I mean, can you stretch yourself that far? I think you already have. I think I already have.
I said, why not?
Yeah.
Let's go a little further with this. And yes, yeah. I do. I, you know, you can call it one name or the other, whether they're Akashic records or a grid, a morphic field. There's so many, you know, again, those are, you know, those are cultural icons you can place on that general idea. But aside from the facts, the hard facts, you know, the people do travel, they communicate, they spread ideas and symbols. I mean, this is true. So the transmission of this data can appear to be just purely physical and relating to contact between cultures. But I ask in the foreword, if someone were to observe the sharing of data between, say, two smartphones and not understand the unseen details behind that process, it would look like the two cell phones simply independently communicated with each other because they were both cell phones, they function the same, and because they simply were close to each other. But what you don't see is the technology behind it, which is, you know, a series of towers that are beaming, you know, information, and it goes cloud. It's very complex, but it's somewhat invisible. So if you had no understanding of that actual science, we could simply start making excuses. Well, of course, these cell phones, they were sitting side by side, therefore they must somehow communicate, and they can communicate because they share a language, a cell phone, and yada, yada. There's a lot of ways you can sort of infer, just trying to take a more, you know, what you see is what you get approach without thinking of what's unseen. So we have the technology to understand the frequency, but we're limited by our. As human beings, we have all been and will have to measure the information that we receive. If we don't have germ theory, it was theory because people said, I can't see the germ. Until you're able to have a microscope to say, I've enhanced my sense with this tool and technology, now I can accept it as science. So I think there are probably...
Uh-oh, you're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, I hope that's better. But yeah, I think there are. Yeah. I think there are numerous things that cannot.
Okay, Heather, you're breaking up. I don't know what it is, but
I don't know either. Sorry about
there
that.
There you go. Oh, that's okay. Okay. Well, hey. Well,
Must
listen.
Be one of those
thank
days.
Yeah, no, we got the gist of it. We got the meat of it, and I appreciate you providing that forward, a little taste of the forward in this book. I'm really suggesting people go out and get this book, Viral Mythology, and your forward really adds to the dimension, to the strength, to the character of this book. And I appreciate you coming on for a few minutes with us this morning.
Oh, well, thank you.
And discussing your point of view. Okay. All right.
Absolutely. Hey, thank you.
You have a great day. And we're looking forward to catching up with you, hopefully in July. We want to hear what's going on with you. So I do want to have you on the program real soon.
Sounds great. I look forward to it. And absolutely. Thank you for having me on. And definitely look at Marie D. Jones' work is wonderful in this Viral Mythology. It's a great book. Definitely pick it up. She does a great job compiling the research.
Great. All right. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye. So that's Dr. Heather Lin. We've had her on the program before, and by the way, if you want to check out her website, drheatherlin.com, her books are really well written, and I do want to have her on again. Her point of view is amazing. Okay, so here is the interview with Marie Jones. By the way, I keep saying Marie Jones. The book was also written by Larry Flaxman. They both have written quite a few books. So here is the interview. I'll come back on at the end. This was recorded a couple of days ago. Marie is actively traveling right now, and she couldn't be on because she's giving a lecture this morning. So here's the talk. So today my guest is Marie D. Jones. Marie is a author. She's actually a prolific author, along with Larry Flaxman. Together they've written 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomenon, The Trinity Secret. And Marie herself has written Destiny Versus Choice, A Scientific and Spiritual Evidence Behind Fate and Free Will, 2013, End of Days or A New Beginning. And interesting, she has an extensive background in metaphysics, cutting-edge science, and the paranormal, and has worked as a field investigator for MUFON, both in L.A. and in San Diego in the 1980s and 1990s. Marie's also appeared on TV, most recently on the History Channel, The Nostradamus Effect, and on Ancient Aliens. We've had quite a few people from Ancient Aliens on our program. Welcome. Welcome to the show, Marie.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'll tell you, the book that we're focusing on today is called Viral Mythology, How the Truth of the Ancients Was Encoded and Passed Down Through Legend, Art, and Architecture. I love that title. I mean, that's a fascinating title, and I haven't read the entire book, but I've seen enough of it. Talked to your publicist, New Page Books, and it really kind of makes you wonder: was there another level of consciousness? And the book actually opens with the question: what does go viral today on the internet with the speed of the internet,
right,
with the
right.
cloud commuting? What is the trigger point which will take an idea, a theory, a photo, or a meme, or whatever, and turn it viral? So I guess the first question I have to have for you is, why a book on viral mythology?
I think you just summed it up. I think for Larry and I, because we sort of, as writers and researchers, we operate in the world of information and ideas and facts and figures and statistics, and sometimes it's really hard to know where an idea originated from, why certain concepts seem to take on a life of their own as opposed to others, you know, why some information is easily spread to other groups of people, why some of it does never see the light of day. But also looking at our own history and realizing that really our history as human beings is nothing more than the accepted body of information that we have sort of collectively agreed upon. Mm-hmm. And that information has come to us from, you know, the course of our history. And it doesn't necessarily mean that's our real history. It's just the information that went viral enough thousands of years ago to keep going and keep going until it reached us today. So that opens up the question, obviously, of, well, what is our real history? How much information is missing? Is there hidden information that we can glean about our origins as human beings and civilizations and how, you know, we arose to civilized society? Is that information hidden in other forms? Those and about 25,000 other questions led to this book, and it really comes down to, again, the idea that we operate in a world of ideas, of information, of facts, stories, news, media, you know, somebody's trying to tell you something and they're hoping that you're going to accept it or believe it or agree with it. And a lot of times now, because we're so distracted, we have information overload and we really don't know what is the truth and what, you know, might be a piece of propaganda or something somebody made up or just bad information being passed along. So that's sort of my little nutshell summary of why we wrote the book.
Wow. Yeah. And the book is packed full of really great references and ideas behind ancient mythology. Would you say that you and Larry found kind of a common thread that pulled you from chapter to chapter, or was it just that the book came together just from your discoveries and your wanting to know more?
I think it's a combination of the two, and what kind of organically happened is we talked about, let's take a look at how a human being evolved, and then let's see if we can apply that to, you know, humanity in general, and interestingly, we can. So we wanted to know what was the first most crude basic forms of spreading information. And that was things like cave art, you know, and rock art, which was very crude. In many cases, it was just etchings and lines and, you know, just the most basic form of trying to express oneself as possible. And we equate that to when we are little. You know, we're 2-3 years old, we're toddlers. How do we communicate? We kind of grunt, you know, we don't quite start to learn a big vocabulary until later. So a lot of it is with emotion, crying and grunting and laughing. But we also pick up those big, fat, cool crayons and we draw pictures. And then from there, as we evolve, as we get older, we discover the written word and we start to be able to communicate verbally using words as well as images. And we see that in history too, with the development of writing, you know, alphabet systems and writing, how things get more sophisticated. Even art at that point gets more sophisticated because we are, we're growing up, we're evolving as a species. And now, you know, we are of technology that just can do amazing things for us, and communication has become a blend of the verbal and the written and, you know, everything else possible as a means of spreading information. And now we have the ability, which we didn't have then, to spread information globally within minutes, within seconds.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about that before we get into the meat of the book. Do you think that as human beings, we have lost something with this technology of the internet, with cloud computing, that was a natural extension of humanity? In other words, you bring up genetic coding or genetic transfer knowledge.
Right.
Do you think that we lose something when we use the internet, or we bury something in the cloud for others to see?
I think there's a, you know, the benefit of when it comes to spreading information, and really think about what is the spread of information about? It's about expression. It's about expression. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to that, the internet is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that we can reach out now to other people that we never could before without immense effort. You know, for us to share a way that we cook food or hunt prey, you know, 3-5,000 years ago, you'd have to walk to get to the next village and spread it that way. Now, you know, hey, I've got a great recipe for how to barbecue ribs. I put it up on Facebook and, you know, somebody in China gets it within seconds. I think that's the fun and the beneficial part of it, is that we can become more global. The bad part of it, the negative part of it, and I think that this is actually sort of getting close to overtaking some of the benefits, is that we are, I think, becoming even more alone and isolated because of the distraction that the internet offers us, and overload of information to where your brain just says, you know what, there's just too much coming at me. I'm going to tune it all out. So those are some of the negatives. And also, you know, we're on the cusp of, I think, where technology is going to overtake our humanity if we're not careful. I was just, you know, telling my son, he goes, Mom, I don't want to go today. It's your graduation. You need to get out of the house and get off that dang computer, you know? And it's like, oh my gosh, it's such a different world now than it was when I was a kid. We were outside every chance we got in nature, and it's a different mindset. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it does have its benefits. And I don't know if it's going to change anytime soon. I think we're addicted to our technology because it is a fine way to spread information and to get information.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, what briefly, do you think?
Well,
I always like to know what other people think about that.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that technology is extremely important. I agree with you. I live on my computer. If I could attach it to my body and carry it. I mean, I have it now in the form of the iPhone.
I think you can. I was going to say you could get the watch, that watch thing.
Oh, forget it. It's as big as your, it's as big as a small, yeah.
It's like having a little brick on your wrist.
Yeah, it's gigantic. No, I mean, I think that there is parts of our biology that we do not understand. I think there's unseen, and we know this from psychic awareness. We know this from intuition. But I think there's subtle energy that is part of our system that is transferred, and we communicate with these other dimensions that are interrupted by overusing the computer. Can't measure that, but I think it's a cause for various types of mental illness. I think we haven't touched it quite yet, but it's coming on strong in different ways. We just haven't identified what it is.
I think that that's really important for people to realize, is that when you're focused 90% of the time on your technology, you're really missing the natural things that are going on in your environment that may contribute to the fact that you feel so much, I love, you know, dis-ease and unease. Those two things seem to be taking over our lives. We either are sick, or we just have a general sense of uneasiness, of anxiety. Yeah. We don't have an inner peace. And I totally agree with you on that. I'm not quite sure how to get people to change, but maybe that's something that's going to happen individually as each person gets to that breaking point of, oh my God, I don't want to feel this way anymore. I'm going to, you know.
I think that at some point they'll have warning labels on your computer. Use for 1 hour and then get up, walk around, come back an hour later.
Like they do on certain pharmaceuticals, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Do not drive heavy equipment after use or whatever.
Yeah,
hey, this book is great. Let's talk a little bit about some viral communication. You have a section in the book that discusses oral history, and I've studied and worked with the Maya, Native Americans, and other old and ancient cultures used oral traditions as a way not only to transmit their personal history, but there may be indications that much more in-depth information may have been transferred. What did you study? What did you discover about that information?
Yeah. When writing came onto the scene, I think people automatically, and I still think this is true today, people automatically trusted the written word as a better means of communication, because we all know that game, what is it called, operator, where, you know, you say something and there's a line of 10 people. And
oh, right,
You know, by the time it gets to the 10th person. Okay, so we know how oral information can be changed, not remembered correctly. But the problem with writing is writing can be embellished, exaggerated, over-dramatized, sensationalized. So after we looked at the two traditions, we started to see a lot of people saying, you know, historians and anthropologists and people that are focused on, you know, mythologists, people like Joseph Campbell even, talking about how important the oral traditions were, because they came, first of all, they came first, which means that the information was more pure. Mm-hmm. And second of all, because when you're talking, you don't, even if you're storytelling, because, you know, we've had storytellers throughout our history, but you still don't have the opportunity to embellish and waste people's time the way you do with the written word. It's more, there's more brevity, there's more clarity. And that was something that really surprised me, because I'm a writer and I always assumed that when you write things down, can more clearly communicate to someone than if you talk or, you know, tell a story or use symbols or even art. I always thought, no, writing, the best way to communicate. It isn't. And it's because of we as human beings, we love to exaggerate. Just go on Facebook and you'll see an awful lot of people exaggerating and embellishing for whatever psychological reasons. I think I've done it myself a few times. But, yeah, that was really surprising how important oral tradition, how some of it is gone. You know, some of it is lost. Every time we lose an indigenous tribe, you know, in the Amazon or what have you, we lose the incredible oral history that they could be giving us as to, you know, part of our species history on this planet. And we don't think about that.
Yeah. So do you think that there is more to just the discussion of a oral historian, or is it the inflection, the energy passed on to another person? I mean, I know in the Mayan groups and tribes that I've spoken with, even to this day, there's one individual who is chosen not only because they can retain the knowledge, but it's how they express the knowledge it carries on their tradition.
I think that's part of the reason why people tend to shun oral information that's passed orally or oral traditions, is because the general public will think that you cannot emote. It's like you're just giving a lecture. But what they don't understand is that some of the most powerful, powerful things, you know, that have moved large groups of people for good and bad have been speeches, rhetoric. Now, I hate to do this, but let's look at Hitler. This was a man who used the power of oral communication, of rhetoric, of choosing words correctly, and emoting properly, that he was able to convince millions of people to support him. And you also have that on the good side, too. I mean, this is something that's used in religion, where you have, you know, a preacher who is very charismatic, opposed to one who just stands up there and lectures and maybe gives you more information, but he doesn't have any passion or emotion to back it up. So you're absolutely right about that. I guess, you know, the idea is to find that best storyteller who can not only convey through words what's important, but through the way, through emotion and the meaning that's put into the words that are chosen.
The section of the book on cave paintings is fascinating, and we've had a couple of different authors on the program talking about different caves and different types of symbology. But it looks in your research that you found encoding, and can you talk a little bit about what that is, what kind of encoding, maybe some kind of signal that was known that was transferred to let people know about, I don't think it was necessarily a time period, because if we're talking 200,000 years ago or older, time was not reasoned in the same way that we think of it today, but maybe these symbols and these codes and these like patterns and dots meant something.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's still a lot of discussion and debate as to what they meant. You know, the dots and lines, you'll hear a lot of experts and researchers say, well, they were keeping track of how many people in their group, or maybe they were keeping track of how much available prey they had noticed was nearby. It could, you know, we weren't there, so we can't know with 100% certainty, but if we look at a lot of the imagery, we learn that very little of that cave and rock art initially included human beings. And if it did, it was often showing them either taking on the behaviors of the animals that were in the area that were known to be prey, or that they would prey upon for food, or worshiping deities. So it's like, okay, that's something that you see in shamanism, where you adopt the behavior of an animal in order to understand it, in order to know its behavior. So the images give us a little bit more to work with. Most of the imagery involved nature, animals, what was going on with the sun and the moon. I mean, these are people that literally observed everything around them. They didn't have computers to distract them from what was going on in nature. Mm-hmm. And as it got more sophisticated, the imagery got more sophisticated. So you see a lot of things like, you know, horse and bison and antelope, different types of animals that they actually lived off of. And if you think about that long ago, what was the most important thing, if not the only thing on their minds? Had to have been. Mm-hmm. But some of the, were they trying to pass on information? I think as we got more sophisticated, we realized that art was a great way to put some hidden information in there for, you know, the allied tribe to figure out, but we didn't want the enemy to know about. And I think, you know, that became another form of expression and of passing on information.
Okay, interesting. How do you think, and you talk a little bit about it, but how do buildings like pyramids, churches, or other structures pass on information and knowledge? I'm just curious about that, how that would work.
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole different mindset today about buildings. We kind of put them up just for profit or, you know, functionality, I guess you could say. Whereas our ancestors, to put up an edifice, especially something like a temple or a shrine or a monument or a church, it meant so much more to them. It was a place of reverence. Oftentimes it was meant to reflect what was going on in nature, usually the cosmos, here down on earth, you know, the whole as above, so below. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of the ancient architecture, you know, not only were the buildings themselves built often on sacred sites, built with certain formulas that had some kind of sacred meaning to these people, but also a lot of the artwork or the sculpturing and carvings in the columns was meant to convey something. And here we are today trying to figure out what that is, because, again, it's up to us to try to interpret the thoughts and motives and agendas of people thousands of years ago. We don't have they didn't leave us a key. You know, here on column A, you'll see a weird bird. wouldn't the history be great if we had that? But we don't. So we have these amazing cathedrals, and we have the pyramids, and we have this thing, we have all this stuff that we are making educated guesses on based upon an excavation site or whatever, but also on our written and oral history, trying to find clues in our stories and myths and the religious texts of different religious traditions. And it's like putting together a big giant puzzle.
Yeah. Did you and Larry come up with a feeling for, say, the ancient Giza pyramids? The structure as a form of communication, or it's just something that you picked up given your research, that these buildings, these what I would consider sacred buildings, were there also to transmit some information?
Yeah, I absolutely think they were. Now, look at the pyramids and how difficult it would even be to build them today. You know, there's still so much arguing and debate over how the heck, who built these? Was it aliens? And so if you look at the amount of time and effort and blood, sweat, and tears that must have gone into building those amazing, you know, even Stonehenge, getting those massive stones in place and getting them positioned so that now we understand that there is a sonic quality to Stonehenge, that you know, it reflects sound waves in a certain way that the people inside the henge could be put in a trance. You know, I mean, how did they know this stuff? So this was important to them. Okay, this was more important to them than it is to us today, where we put up a condominium building because we want to make a profit, and right, we try to cram as many units into as small as, and we don't think about where we're putting it either. Are we putting it on for an Indian burial ground? Who cares, as long as we make money? But at that time, you know, with the pyramids, that amount of effort and something that massive, and just the fact too that it is the pyramid shape, which is itself such a sturdy and, you know, formidable shape to put a structure in, because it's bottom heavy. So you've got that very small top, you know, the ability for time to knock that puppy down is just not going to happen. How did they know these things? But also, you know, we've learned more about the pyramids. We still don't understand everything, but we've learned that within the King's Chamber, there are certain resonant frequencies that literally alter consciousness if you happen to be laying in the chamber. And, you know, we know there are all kinds of mysterious tunnels, and it really is not what we originally thought it was.
Yeah.
So to the people who built it at that time, they were trying to tell us something. Well, maybe not us necessarily. Maybe they weren't thinking thousands of years into the future, but they were definitely thinking more than, let's just put up a building.
Right. Amazing. I want to get into mythology, myths, and you have a big section of your book that discusses not only Greek and Roman myths, but just what the information was that was delivered. I tend to think that, at least in a lot of the Mayan myths and the Native American myths, they are part of a true story. And we all know that Heinrich Schliemann took some of those fables, the fable story of Troy, and actually used that to find the place, dig Troy. But I'm wondering what your feeling is on these myths and the stories, and if they were created to not only provide lessons and information, or I mean, if they're a form of information that we just don't understand today.
Are there in there? Yeah, you know, to tell you the truth, that's probably the number one question that drove at least my interest as a writer. You know, I also write fiction, and one of the things that we came to realize was that in many ways, even if you look at the novels and movies and television shows of today, in many ways, they are more truthful about what it means to be a human being and about what we go through and experience than nonfiction, than fact and statistic and, you know, that kind of fiction is truth shielded in story. And so, okay, now can we go back and look at the myths of old and the fairy tales and the folklore and the tall tales and nursery rhymes and legends and even, you know, the ballads. I mean, everything was a form of communication. Some of it very well may have been just for sure entertainment, the way, you know, today you might have the movie The Hangover. But even then, you know, that movie does convey a lot about some people's behaviors. But, you know, was it meant, were those stories meant to be an interpretation? And here's what I think. Were they interpretations of what was going on around these people? Didn't have the scientific acumen yet to be able to explain any other way than to put it into a story. A very wild, embellished, you know, awesome, often incredibly violent story. And you think about when they were experiencing natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, to these people at that time. They did not know about fault lines and magma chambers and pyroclastic flow. To them, an erupting volcano was the wrath of the god that lived at the base of the volcano. That's how they interpreted the natural world. And they, you know, they put it into a story about gods and goddesses because they didn't understand some of the more scientific explanations for what happens in nature, physics and things. You know, they didn't have that knowledge then, or they did have the knowledge, but they didn't have the means of expressing it that we have today. So to me,
yes,
those stories have so much truth in them. Find a way to weed it out from the embellishment and also the interpretation that's just based on what knowledge they had at the time. And I've always loved Joseph Campbell's work, and I've always loved this idea that if you look for the common themes in all of the myths, no matter what part of the world they came from, you know, you start to see truths about the human experience. Maybe some of these people lived, maybe they didn't. Maybe some of these events actually happened, and just over time they became these wonderful embellished stories. So now the job today is to go back and try to figure out what's truth and what's embellishment.
I found it interesting in your description of the Greek and Roman myths, how they embed ethical and moral codes.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I found that, you know, how to be an probably things like how to be an upstanding citizen and how to live your the right way and things like that. I'm guessing, but
And you know, like the Arthurian, the King Arthur stories did the same thing. They were moral and ethical, you know, suggestions, quote unquote. And if you think about today, maybe not so much now, but when we were kids, you know, parents telling us fairy tales. Well, a lot of those fairy tales were meant to drive home a certain point about behavior, especially the Grimm fairy tales. Really, a lot of those were very fear-based. You know, you better be careful. You don't do this. You don't talk to strangers. You don't go into strange people's houses. You know, don't go near wild animals. I mean, I think that that's still true today. But at the time, you know, the Greek and the Romans were very much into ethics, and even though they had their own issues with actually being ethical people, I think that they realized that there's a much easier way to get people to behave ethically and morally, tell them a story, rather than get in their face and you know, just say, you need to be a better person. What do we do when somebody says that to us? We shut down. You know, we sort of go into defense mode. But if I read a wonderful story about someone who realized, you know, how damaging it was to lie to a child or whatever, I think my conscience is going to take that to heart much more than if somebody says it to me, you know, to where it's appealing to my intellect. So I think that they recognize that you could get those moral and ethical stories, those codes of behavior in there, where they would affect the subconscious via story, via myth, and nobody could accuse you of, you know, getting in their faces. And
that's fascinating. Yeah.
I
never thought of it like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have kids? You know, try telling your kids something.
Yeah.
Try saying, you know, you're, I don't know, just try telling your kids something with that sort of direct parenting tone. But then if they read it in a story, then they pick, it's like the subconscious absorbs that very same lesson you're trying to teach them. But, you know, they're not putting up that, oh, mom, dad, defend, I'm not going to listen to you. And it's the same thing. And what Larry and I discovered writing this book is that human behavior has not changed. In essence, the same. But we have found so many new ways to express that. That sameness, that, you know, humanity that's always been there.
Fascinating. You know, I want to talk a little bit about comparative mythology because this is something that fascinates me. And that is, a story is told in one part of the world, and then a similar story or myth is recreated in a thousands and thousands of miles away, where there was no way for the two groups to connect with each other, and yet there's so many dynamics that are similar within the two stories that you have to wonder, that's too close to be random. I mean, there must be part of human nature that is, or storytelling that is sent to a giant cloud in the sky that is left there for others to pick up on or something. I don't know how to explain it. Yeah, do you have an explanation for it?
Well, I think, you know, you're talking about external influences, and I think that there's also internal influences. And I think the reason why you find so many common motifs, whether we're talking about the Tree of Life or a flood, a story, or the Green Man, or you know, different gods and goddesses that appear in Greek and Roman mythology and Norse mythology, and they have very same characteristics, different names. I think as we evolved as human beings, we were having experiences that were the same, evolving at the same rate as, you know, people thousands of miles away. So some of the expressive stories that we were telling, we're going to have those common threads. It also may be that some of the same external influences were imprinting upon everybody, regardless of what region of the world you lived in, and therefore the stories reflected it. Let's talk about the Great Flood. I mean, there is so much evidence that, you know, approximately 12,000 years ago, there was a global flood, and some experts say that we had a real close flyby with an asteroid or a comet. Mm-hmm. It could have been some very severe seismic activity going on, whatever. But we find the flood story everywhere, including the Bible. Everybody knows the story of Noah and the Ark. Guess what, folks? There may be some truth to that. Not necessarily that he took two of each on a boat, but that was their expression of this horrendous flood that was killing a lot of people and a lot of animals and a lot of wildlife around them. And they didn't know what was happening. And they equated it with an angry God punishing them. And there were survivors. And so those survivors must be special. They must be blessed. I mean, it's almost like if you go try to put yourself back in time and think with the brain you have now, but in a simplistic way, you can almost understand where these stories came out of their minds based on what they were experiencing. But I like to think, and I think that there's a lot of interesting evidence that points to the fact that consciousness, you know, a lot of people believe it exists outside of the body. Like you said, sort of like a cloud, being into that consciousness from wherever we live in the world. We're going to have images, ideas, you know, innovations that are going to be similar, whether we're in the east or the west or the north and the south. I think it's a combination of the internal and the external that was playing upon them.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's other than the flood, there's other stories of various gods, various actions that people have taken that are one society will claim it, and then it'll show up again somewhere else. It's like, where did you get that? You know, I don't know.
One of the biggest ones is the Jesus persona that has existed throughout time in different forms. You know, the hero, the monomyth of the hero. We see that in so many different writings, and it's something that we still see today in a lot of movies and novels and fictional, you know, TV shows. Right. You know, even the idea of a Jesus figure is repeated in many different parts of the world, but with different names. And so you start to wonder, you know, what was really going on? Was there one event that everybody was somehow experiencing, albeit a little bit differently based on where they lived? Or were there many events happening at the same time based on the fact that we were all at the same level of evolution, whether we're talking physical or consciousness.
Interesting.
And I'm just fascinated by, you know, and the bummer is because we weren't there. And I hate this part of it. Everything that we do today is about putting together a big giant puzzle of which we're probably always going to be missing some pieces. Look for the common themes. And when you find common themes in writing and art and oral traditions, then you get the men and the women who look for the physical evidence, the anthropologists, mm-hmm. the archaeologists, the people that are digging up the world and saying, oh my gosh, look, we found evidence that the flood happened here too. Or you get geologists and geophysicists in there, and they're saying, look at this. You know, the geological record shows about 12,000 years ago there was a flood here, and in the rock sediment, you know, here, the sediment layers here. When they start coming up with physical proof of what all of these stories are talking about, that's when it gets really exciting.
Exactly, and not cover it up either, right? I mean, that's, you know, somebody finds a rudimentary computer, they better not bury it. They better come out with it. Isn't the cloud kind of like what psychics consider the Akashic Records, where it's supposed to be this historic before time, now, and into the future, is accessible by these highly intuitive either psychics or spiritualists or whatever? Because I don't know enough about the Akashic Records, but I do know from what I have read and from those who actually are able to, they claim to be able to tap into, the Akashic Records are a form of the cloud, where there's a database of this information. So
exactly.
What do you think about that? Do you have any sense about that?
Yeah, I love it. This is one of my most favorite things in the world. There's a scientific basis for that as well, called the zero-point field, which has been, you know, speculated by some theoretical and quantum physicists as a repository of all information, past, present, and future, where there is no linear time. What they mean by that is when you talk about information, you're talking about everything that exists is information. It's a bundle of information, either formulated to be a chair or a galaxy or a human being or a dog, and that there is a field from which all of this comes from and is then returned to. And it is like a virtual field of quantum particles just popping up and in and out of existence, and everything that we think of as form, matter, energy comes
from. Well, let me interrupt you real quickly. Are you talking about the morphogenic field?
That's a similar theory. Larry and I call it the grid, and we wrote a book about our take on it, which we look at sort of like a multi-leveled grid of information and realities that some people have the ability to tap into. You know, when you talk about a field, the Akashic field, and, you know, some people call it the book of life, the kingdom of heaven. If you go back into the Bible and read the first description of the kingdom of heaven, you know, actually all of the references, it's absolutely amazing how it aligns with the Akashic field, the morphogenic field, the grid, the zero-point field. It is, you know, the kingdom that is invisible, but it's laid out before us, it's through us, everybody is immersed in it. It sounds like, you know, all this dark energy that people are looking for, but it's invisible. But what bothered Larry and I about when you tell somebody field, they get a two-dimensional concept. And we thought, you know what, we like to call it a grid, because the way that we see reality, the way that we see this field, is that this is not the only reality that there is. There are possibly an infinite number, and it looks like a three-dimensional grid. And there are times when we are able to move from one level of the grid to another to access information. And I think psychics, remote viewers, people have precognitive visions or dreams, past life recall. I think that's what we're doing. I even think deja vu is accessing information in that non-linear field. And I love this theory because if there indeed is an informational field that really any of us can access, you know, some better than others, but we all should be able to, it could account for so much of the similarities and the spread of ideas and concepts from our past when we didn't have cell phones and computers.
That's
one of the theories, and I love that theory because I think it really has even a scientific basis to it.
Do you think that we as human beings have always been wired the same? I mean, biologically wired the same? And I ask that because it seems to me that different cultures, and I'm going to use the Maya, who I've spent a lot of time with down in Mexico,
right,
to as an example. They're actually trained, the shaman, they're called day keepers, to access various regions of their brain that actually can help them by locate, meaning they can be in one place and then consciously be somewhere else. They also can go into meditative states by shifting the patterns of their brain waves to access knowledge about medicine. I mean, this is something that we've either lost or we just are not using. It's just amazing to think about. And by not using it, it might be a detriment. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I totally agree with you. We all have the same brain. I mean, we all have brains. They're all human. I don't have a lizard brain. We all have the ability to access those sort of supernatural qualities, but not all of us do. And I think it's because not all of us feel we have a need to. You know, again, here in the United States, we're so overwhelmed with technology and gadgets and you know, what's Taylor Swift up to? And there's just such a surface level of existence here. And I, you know, I love her, so she's a doll, but there's such a surface level of existence in certain parts of the world where very few people go outside in nature and get quiet for very long periods of time where they can actually tune into the connection that they have, not only with the world around them, but with the world within them. And I think we've lost some of the magical abilities that we've always had in our past. Are we biologically wired the same? I think that, yeah, the potential is still there. It probably is even stronger now as we've evolved, and I think our brains have become bigger. But we've also given in to a lot of external influences that I think keep us from realizing how powerful we are.
It's too bad. I think,
I mean, when you're down with the Mayans, do they have cell phones? Do they have computers? I'm curious if they've, like,
well,
yeah, I mean, if they did, they probably would have the ability to control it, you know?
I wouldn't be surprised. They could probably turn it on and off with a thought. I don't know. It just seems, when I was reading your book, it just seems that, like, the transfer of information is not as clearly defined as we understand it. I think there are patterns and brain waves and energetic fields, as you and Larry call them, that do not have the equipment to detect yet. I think that we're getting there.
I think we experience them now and then, and we just don't know how to describe it or categorize it because science hasn't caught up to it yet. You know, one thing we didn't even talk about, too, is the fact that there are a lot of people who believe in the ancient alien, ancient astronaut theory for the advancement of, you know, humanity and the spread of information. I'm not sure that I buy into that one as much. I do think that we indeed, you know, could have been visited. There's an awful lot of iconography that supports that and stories as well. But I still think that as human beings, we're capable on our own of making great leaps in our evolution and development, if that's what we want, I think technology derails us from that goal a little bit. Well, maybe not a little bit, a lot.
We only have a few minutes left, and I just want to ask you a couple more questions. Tell me really briefly how this Archaeo Enigmas got in your book, because it's a fascinating subject that I've always been curious about, anomalous objects found in ancient burial sites and things like that. But how does that play a part in the in virality of information? I just it's a fascinating look at those things, though.
Yeah, these are like the cogs that get thrown into the wheel onto the stop.
Oh, okay.
They make us question our history and what we think is our history. It's new information that makes you go, hey, wait a minute. Maybe our history is not what we've been told. You know, Archaeo Enigma, I found that name on a Facebook page, absolutely fascinating page. And, just items and objects and discoveries that are either out of place or out of time within the construct of where or when they're discovered. And they can be anything from objects that are dug up on a particular excavation site, where, you know, they're digging up a village that's 2,000 years old and they find an object that's 5,000 years old or that's very modern, in fact, you know, something that looks like a light bulb or behaves like a battery, something that at that point in time should not have been discovered or developed yet. And what this suggests is that either these, you know, during these time periods, there were always prodigies and brilliant minds and geniuses that were developing these things, because that information was out there in the field, you know, and they tapped into it. And they just somehow got lost or suppressed, or, you know, nobody believed them or thought they were crazy. Some people think that these are little bits of evidence and proof that we were being assisted by alien civilizations who were trying to show us how to make a battery or a light bulb or, you know, some kind of new metal to build our buildings with that didn't exist before. So we don't know. We don't know. You know, was this stuff that somebody with a brilliant mind thought up and it got buried when the volcano erupted and covered the village in ash? Or was this something that was given to these people?
So do you believe in, do you believe in, like, cycles of humanity? Like, I'm sure you've read Michael Cremo's book, who follows the yugas, which are that man's been around for millions of years. In fact, tens of or hundreds of millions of years, modern human, and just through various cycles of their own hand destroying themselves or through cosmic catastrophes, a high advanced civilization will be destroyed only to be rebuilt, and then the cycle completes itself. So that's how I would explain those kind of things.
I think about the story of Atlantis. I mean, that's the story of Atlantis. And again, are we seeing truth that is seeping into our legends and lore and our myths of, you know, we know that history repeats itself. We know that empires rise and fall. So how long has that been happening? And are the cycles, like you said, sometimes be of our own doing, sometimes it's nature. And I think we still have that mentality where you've got all these end of the world people that, you know, the end timers that anytime a weird date shows up, like December 21st, 2012, people are, here it is, whether that date has any validity or not. I still think that belief is like embedded in us, that we understand their cycles. I mean, come on, we're born, we live, and we die. Why would that not also apply to humanity in general? So yeah, that's a fascinating question.
It's a real curious one. I would love for someone to figure out some biological computer that we could tap into these morphogenic or Akashic fields, or whatever you want to call it, so we could say, okay, it happened 2 million years ago. This is it. We have proof.
You know what? Who knows? I mean, that and time travel could happen 5 years from now. The way that technology is advancing, it's kind of scary, you know?
Wow. It is. That would be a quantum leap. And, of course, if you read like I do, you read I don't know if you know the Corso papers, Captain Corso, who wrote, worked with the military and said that a lot of our technology has been reverse engineered from downed UFOs.
Engineered, yeah. Area 51.
It's like, okay.
You know, who knows? Wouldn't it be funny if they were all right in their own way? But, it's just this desire to understand who we are and where we came from that drives all of this. And, again,
exactly.
We're dealing with the information that went viral and made it to us in one piece, maybe not even really in one piece, but it also begs the question, what information is missing?
Well, that leads to the last question here. What kinds of viral mythology are we leaving behind today for future generations to discover? That's a curious one.
Oh, gosh. Everybody's a terrorist. You have no privacy. Celebrities are, all have their own reality shows. It's funny because, we landed somebody on the moon. We have those milestones that will historically be passed down and, we went to another planet. I'm sure we're going to go to Mars at some point. But when you look today at how much of the information that we have that is so dumb and trivial and meaningless, and you wonder, was that the case back then too? It just didn't have it wasn't important enough to make it down here today to us. It didn't go viral. Or is it just a different time, and our future generations going to look back at us and say, those people were crazy. They destroyed the planet. They didn't care about the environment. They had so much waste. And I think that's the question everybody might want to think about. What are we leaving for the next generation? Because we're making their history now, and I don't know that many people care. I think, it's all about just me and my family. And once, 2,000 years from now, I'll be long dead. Who cares? But
you don't think the Kardashians are important historical facts?
You know what? I think they're important. I think they're important in the message that their celebrity sends about humanity. And that's it. That's it. I think that is so telling about, are we so in fear? Of what are we afraid of that we allow our lives to be so distracted by somebody else's life? What does that mean? I think that's probably one of the big sociological questions of our time. How did reality shows, quote unquote, how did celebrity get to the point where now anybody can be a celebrity? And, what are we all avoiding by looking at other people's, my opinion?
Either that, or we've all been dumbed down by the openness of the internet. We can see, do, and hear
nothing
anything.
Nothing is private anymore. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. We're all just like, here I am, an open book. Well, I might not necessarily want to read that book, but
your book, Viral Mythology, is a wonderful read. The subtitle is How the Truth of the Ancients Was Encoded and Passed Down Through Legend, Art, and Architecture. My guest today has been Marie Jones. I want to have you on the program again because another discussion for you is, and I'm an aspiring writer myself, is you pump out a book almost every 12 months.
I love to talk about writing. Oh, I love to.
Jesus.
Well, let's do it.
We'll have to do that sometime.
You send me some times and we'll do it. And I promise there won't be a whole lot of graduations.
Well, hey, no, congratulations to your son. It's a big day for you. And
thank
as we
you.
Spoke about
I know.
Program, it's a marker. So, hey, have a great day and appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you so much. We'll talk again. Bye-bye.
Okay. So that's Marie Jones and the book, Viral Mythology. I really suggest that you go out and get it. It's on Amazon. And the important thing about books today is you don't need to have them in your hand anymore. You can have a digital copy, which means that you download it, and you don't need to have a Kindle tool. You don't need to have a special reader. It'll format on your computer. So consider getting the book in a digital form and then just uploading it. Hey, the other thing is it's a lot cheaper. Usually they're a third as much. So Check that out. Viral Mythology. It's kind of a cool book. So that was the interview with Marie Jones. Viral Mythology, as I said, is a cool book. There's so much we don't know about ancient history. All we have to go with is the ruins that are left to us, and a few bits of scrolls and parchment that have some information on it. So, God, I was listening to that and I was thinking, why did I mention Kim Kardashian? And that's like, oh God. Anyhow, that's our program for the day. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we're talking about communing with nature and how the ancients actually spoke through nature and had the ability to work and understand natural forms and earth-based forms. My guests are specialists in the book. Actually, that we'll be talking about is called Speaking with Nature, an Ancient Point of View. I hope you have a great day, and we'll look forward to having you with the program again.